Good morning.
So we are trying out some new technology. So if it works great, it's because of me, and if it doesn't, it's because of them. Guide my feet. Good song, right? Guide my feet. It causes some trouble with some people, though. Who are you talking to? Right? Remember that. We're going to come back to that a little bit later. So it's Father's Day. Isn't Father's Day a great day? Do you know that Father's Day in America was an afterthought? Father's Day was basically designed because, well, we have Mother's Day. We should probably have a Father's Day. And if I'm being cynical, I'll go so far as to say, we sell a lot of greeting cards on Mother's Day. Maybe we should have a Father's Day too. In Catholic Europe, though, Father's Day has been a tradition for centuries. It's celebrated on St. Joseph's Day. Duh. San Jose in Spain, right? San Jose in Portugal. It's St. Joseph's Day. March 19th is St. Joseph's Day. St. Joseph's Day is such a big festival in Spain that the whole city of Valencia shuts down for a week. So to give you some idea, the difference is how Father's Day is looked at, right? It's very, very different. If you want to take a guess at what's important to men in America, you can listen to Father's Day ads on the radio. And if you listen to Father's Day ads on the radio, you quickly begin to learn that what's important to men is apparently power tools, cooking outside, and beer. If you were an alien landing from another planet wondering what fatherhood is like on the world and you listen to Father's Day ads, that would be your view of the American male. Beer drinking, meat eating, power tool using. Lowe's has an ad that I've been in the car. I listen to this ad and I chuckle hysterically because I don't even know what the hell it is they're selling. They've got this thing, I think it's called a reciprocal bandsaw. And I'm wondering, what's a reciprocal bandsaw? Is it a bandsaw that if you buy it a drink, it buys you a drink? Like, if you invite it to your house, it invites you to its house? You know, what is a reciprocal? And apparently people want these things, and apparently men want these things. And it makes me feel inferior. I will tell you that I learned a lot going through seminary, some of it very theoretical, some of it very practical. And there was one point a while back where I was talking to a minister, and that minister was putting me on the schedule to preach on Mother's Day. And I said to that minister, I said, you know what's funny? I've preached the last like 5 Mother's Days in all different congregations. And the minister looked at me and said, that's not funny at all. Nobody wants to preach on Mother's Day. Because people's relationships with their mothers are all over the place, right? It goes from Mother Teresa to know why your hangers, right? And everything in between. And even stuff off to the side. So it's very difficult to address mothers from a pulpit, but Mother's Day is actually easier because you can make it abstract. It's got the whole anti-war thing and the history and how it started and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Father's Day doesn't have any of that. So she said to me, the only thing worse than preaching on Mother's Day is preaching on Father's Day. Because people's relationships with their fathers are even on a wider scale, right? I found that really, really interesting. So most of the time on Father's Day, you get a service about something other than Father's Day. So I decided, not this year, when they put me on the schedule for Father's Day, I said, I'm going to talk about Father's Day. And I said, what would you talk about if you were going to talk about Father's Day? What would you talk about? And my head went all over the place. This service has been rewritten like 900 times. And I remember this December I had the joy of spending an entire month with my mother, who had gotten sick and lost her mobility. So I spent the entire month of December with her in Florida. We couldn't go anywhere. She couldn't move. So we talked a lot. And the conversation occasionally came to my grandfather. And I remember listening to her and not saying anything. But I remember thinking, I don't think my grandfather was a very nice person. Actually, I think he was kind of awful when you hear the stories that she told about my grandfather. But she told them so matter-of-factly. There was no pain in her voice. That's just the way it was. And I thought to myself, wow, what must that have been like for her growing up with a father like that? And, you know, not, you don't need details, but let's just say he put her in orphanages twice, right? In the 30s and 40s. So that's exactly the point. Her point was basically, that was not unusual then. That was how things were. And I kind of thought to myself, that's a little bit of a cop-out in a way. And maybe that's from my perspective in 2015 or 2018, right? But I remember thinking, there's a definition of fatherhood that has certainly shifted over those 40 or 50 years, or whatever, I didn't do the math, 70 years. That definition has radically shifted. And what was acceptable for your parents even not too long ago is not acceptable anymore. And right now in history, we are going through a period of time where the definition of masculinity is being evaluated and redefined. In the 70s, we did that with femininity, right? We had the Women's Lib movement where we as a community tried to define what being a woman was. Interestingly, a lot of those definitions were created by men, but that's a separate topic. And then we did it again with the LGBT movement, where we fought through a definition of what it means to be married, right? And the question really in all of these, and right now we're doing masculinity, and the question in all of these seems to boil down to not so much what it means to be female or feminine, well, not so much what it means to be male or masculine, not so much what it means to be gay or straight or married, but who gets to choose? Who gets to define? Who has the power to define what it means to be any of these things? That's really a big question. Right? That's one of the big kickbacks against the Women's Lib movement of the 70s and why we're getting neo-feminism coming up right now. Again, I don't want to say coming up, it's here. But it's coming up because really what's happening is that the feminists of today are realizing that a lot of the lenses through which femininity was defined in the 70s was through a masculine lens. So that's being rejected at some point right now, right? So you have this argument over who gets to define. And that brings us to the religious question and the Unitarian Universalist question, who gets to define? And part of it is a self-definition. Do we get to self-define? And I think that's an academic question. Because we do self-define, don't we? If you think you're married, you're married. That the law might disagree with you, but the hell with the law. Do you think you're married? Do you think you're male? Who gets to say, no, 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 you're not male? Who gets to say that? When you think about the essence of humanity, We don't get to say that. We like to think we get to say that. We have Congress and people wearing expensive suits and a bunch of lawyers who will spend years and years and years defining who's married, who's male, who's masculine, who's feminine. Oh, and it's exhausting. But the truth is, you really do get to define. And I will say to you that not only do you get to define, you have to define. As a Unitarian Universalist, one of the core functions, one of the core things for us is these seven principles, right? And I think that this self-definition is a mashup of the first four principles. That's how important it is. We only have seven. It takes up four. It's pretty important. If you look at the first four principles, if you want to follow along, they're inside the cover of your book, your hymnal. So the first principle is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Who gets to define what the inherent worth and dignity is of a person? The second is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. How just and equitable is it for you to overlay your stuff on someone else? It's really not at all, is it, right? Lewis Black has a bit that says, you're a grown man. You want to wear a Batman costume to work? Go for it. And there's some truth in that, isn't there? Conforming to what everybody else thinks we have to be, is it choice or is it guide my feet? Who's guiding my feet? The third principle, acceptance of one another, encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Acceptance of one another, it doesn't say unless, right? It just says acceptance of one another. Acceptance of one another unless you're a jerk. It doesn't say that. It just says acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. So there's a kind of flip right there, right? So acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. I accept you, but you really need to work on that. There's a little bit in there, isn't there, right? And then the fourth one, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. This one drives me crazy. This one can be an entire sermon all to itself, but a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, right? That does not mean that if I decide I want to search for truth and meaning, I get to do it on my own terms. That means you should really be involved in a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. So when you mash those all four up together, you get a self-aware self-definition. Very important, a self-aware self-definition. Self-aware, I'm aware of my limitations, I'm aware of who I am, and a self-definition, right? Let me give you an example of an unself-aware self-definition. An unself-aware self-definition would be me saying, I want to be the center fielder for the Boston Red Sox. That may be who I define myself as, but that ain't very self-aware. Everybody knows I can't make that throw anymore, right? Right. So if you take the first four principles and mash them together, you get something like a self-aware self-definition. And it's not a, oh yeah, if you feel like it, it's a, oh yeah, it's human. This is what defines humanity, is to be involved in a self-aware self-definition. So go back to guide my feet. Who you talking to? You talking to me? You talking to God? Or you talking to everybody in this room? Who you talking to? As a Unitarian Universalist, it is what this tells me is this mashing together of these four principles tells me that as a Unitarian Universalist, it is your responsibility that if I ask you what it means to be masculine, what it means to be feminine, what it means to be married, you are responsible to make absolutely sure that you give me your answer, not their answer. The song is Guide My Feet. not move my feet for me. You still have to walk. So let's get back to masculinity for a minute. It's a national focus right now, and it just so happens to be Father's Day. So let's talk about it. I was doing a lot of research for this talk, and I found an article in the National Review, which is a right-leaning, I don't really know, it seemed to be really right-leaning, and Walter's nodding his head, yeah, it's a right-leaning, it was an awful article, it wasn't written very well, it wandered all over the place, it made these weird jumps, like, you know, if this, then that, what, you know. But anyway, it defined a conservative viewpoint of masculinity. So I didn't know if it was true. It also defined a liberal viewpoint of masculinity, which I knew wasn't true. So I called some conservative-leaning friends and said, hey, does this make sense to you? And one of them, we ended up in a story. He ended up telling me a story that I think really made a lot of sense when looking at this topic of who gets to define and who's responsible for self-definition. He said he was very opposed to several parts of what the conservative writer had said. He was also very opposed to what I was saying, but that's a separate issue. So he said in the conversation, he said, let me give an example. He said, one day I did something stupid. I drove my car too fast and crashed into a wall. I ruined my car and I ruined the wall. And I remember way back when he did this. There was a lot of extenuating circumstances involved. But he said, that wasn't because I was masculine. That was just because I was stupid. And I said, well, stupid's a pretty big word. Like, how do you, there are lots of things that you could have done that would have been stupid. How are you going to define this as part of this? And he said, okay, let me give you an example. He said, let's say it was dark, it was raining, I didn't know where I was, and the speed limit went from 70 down to 40, and I wasn't paying attention, I didn't see it. So then a curb came up, and I didn't see it, and I reacted too late, and I skidded into the wall, and I ruined the car, and I ruined the wall. That's stupid. And he said, and I said, yeah, that's stupid. He said, there's no difference between that and I was doing it because I thought it was manly. I thought I was being a he-man. And I said, yeah, there's really a difference between that because a woman could have easily done the thing where she missed the speed limit falling and she didn't see the way she hit. Anybody could have done that. That wasn't endemic to being masculine. That wasn't endemic to acting masculine. That was endemic to not seeing a speed limit sign. So there is a fundamental difference between what drives you. And if that drive, so I said to him, I said, let's say that you defining yourself as masculine by driving your car too fast, who put that in your head? Or how did that get in your head? Or did you create that yourself? And he went on to tell me all these stories about cowboys and John Wayne. And so the point was clear that that came from the external, right? So I started wondering about how much of what we are comes from external sources, guide my feet, who you talking to, and how much of it comes from internal sources. And I reflected back on a sermon that I heard here by Chris Belikoff. Is Chris not here, right? I was sitting right about where Lucy Hoffman is sitting, and it was a great sermon. And the focus of the sermon was this song, Unwritten. And I remember I was so enthusiastic about this song. It was so wonderful. I get to write my own future. The rest is still unwritten. I know it was aimed at 14-year-olds, but it made sense to me right then. Okay, and I just latched onto it. It was so great. But as I've gone on in time, I began to sort of realize that I think some of my book is written for me. And I don't know what part of it is written for me. I don't know what part of it is in me that would make, maybe I would accidentally drive my car into a wall. I don't know. So what part of your book is still unwritten? And what part of your book was written for you? What part of your book is within your control to write? And what part of your book is kind of other people's stuff laid in to you? What part, who are you talking to? Guide my feet, but you still have to walk. So when you mash all this stuff together, you get a very different viewpoint as being a Unitarian Universalist that has to do with a theological construct called agency. This is a big deal. Agency varies amongst different religions. Who is in charge? There are some Christian theologians who say you are powerless to overcome original sin and you need Jesus or God or whatever to help you do that. And then you get all the way to Unitarian Universalists who are all over the place, but some of us believe that agency is within our own hands. Guide my feet. And how much of agency is written for you? How much do you believe? What is your underlying belief around agency, and what is your underlying belief around how much of what you are is you, written by you, and how much of what you are is put there by someone else? And that, I think, is the question for Father's Day. How much of you is you? I don't know what a reciprocating bandsaw is. And I felt bad for not having one, not wanting one, and most of all, not knowing what the hell it was. How can something so important be zero part of my life? I felt bad right there for a minute. Just for a minute. Who put that in me? I don't think I did. And that's what we're looking at Father's Day today. How much of you is you? How much of you is other people writing your book for you? So as we leave here today, just look at your book. Try to figure out how much of it is you and how much of it is other people. As Natasha Bedingfield says, no one else can feel it for you. Only you can let it in. Speak the words on your lips. Today is where your book begins. May it be so. Amen.